Well, this week's guest on Macquarie Street Matters is the member for Willoughby, the great Tim James. So welcome, Tim. Thanks for joining us.
It's a real pleasure. I'm glad to be with you.
It's great to have you in the, you know, we're not quite on couches, but it's great, it's great to have you in the...
Oh, I think the studio's fantastic.
In our podcasting environment. Now, I don't really fully know where to start other than to say you became the member for Willoughby in March of 2022, and so you actually had to fight two elections within 12 months.
Correct. It's been a whirlwind period, two massive campaigns, by-election in February, but result declared in March, so you're right, and then March this year. So, like, just over 12 months, two huge campaigns, and then, you know, big, some life events in between. We had a baby.
You had a baby 2 weeks after you...
6 days after
six days. Okay.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
6 days after you're elected to Parliament. Yes. And your journey to Parliament had been a long one, and we'll go into that.
Sure.
But let's just start. One of the things that struck me in your inaugural address, and I was privileged to be in the chamber when you delivered it, was the deep connection that your family has with actually the Willoughby electorate in the area.
Something I'm very proud of.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so my family goes back to the 1880s in Crysnest, Nicholson Street, Crysnest, where my great-great-grandparents lived, George and Maria. George, this is on my dad's side of the family. George was, in fact, on the founding committee of the Royal North Shore Hospital, where decades later I would be born. My sister, mum, worked there for 20 years. Dad was born there, etc.
My grandfather was a resident in 1919 at Royal North Shore Hospital.
That's impressive.
He was a young doctor.
Yeah, so then five generations have subsequently lived in and served Willoughby in different ways, you know, sports, community, and now a bit of politics.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah. And one of the really interesting things I thought you had to share in your inaugural speech was the fact that at the age of 11, you'd been told that you were going to go blind.
Yeah, yeah, that's a pretty confronting thing in life. I was young, but old enough to understand, you know, when the optometrist, ophthalmic surgeon actually, as he was, said to me, "Tim, your vision will progressively get worse." And I remember thinking to myself, well, where does that end? And actually, we knew the answer to that. Now, turns out that was a misdiagnosis, but we lived with that for a good few months. And, you know, I remember...
I wasn't sure what happened. So it was a misdiagnosis.
Yeah, it was. But for a good few months, that was the diagnosis. I mean, this was one of the foremost experts in our country. Yeah. We ended up... Mum actually took me to America to get a second opinion. When there was then some doubt here in Australia was cast upon that diagnosis, we went to America, to San Francisco actually, and got absolute clarity on the state of my eyes. Well, and that was obviously life-changing, you know, experience.
Well, no one wants a misdiagnosis, but if it means that you're okay, I suppose that's the best kind you can have.
Yeah, so I always give thanks for my vision, and I'm ever conscious of how different my life could have been.
Yeah.
Really, could have been substantially different.
And your parents, Bruce and Trish, two lovely people. Unfortunately, your father's passed away since.
Yeah, God rest his soul.
Come into Parliament, but at least he, and I guess it was earlier this year, but at least he saw you.
He did.
Share that great moment, as did my father, who actually died 6 years ago today. Yeah. But what impact as an 11-year-old did you see that had on your parents?
Well, they were struggling with it, grappling with it. I think any parents would on getting the notification that their child is going to go blind. Mm. I mean, I remember, I you know, you try to be strong and stoic even at a young age and stage, but I remember seeing, you know, Mum in the kitchen on the phone. You know, we didn't have mobiles back then. The, you know, phone was attached to the wall, and I remember tears streaming down her cheeks as she spoke to me.
Well, the fact that they went to the United States to get, you know, to get clarity is pretty amazing in itself. Your father was actually on my pre-selection, and I remember we had a phone call. I don't think I'd ever met your father. We had a phone call, a bit of a discussion. He was quite interested in my father's time in the Dutch resistance on. And I think your father had sort of was obviously interested.
Dad was a real student of history, of World War history, military history, and someone that deeply appreciated, you know, those who fought for what was right for our world.
Yeah. Now, you were up in my electorate last weekend to launch a book. And it was great to see your mother looking after your son, helping look after your son while you got up and gave a speech. So that's nice. You obviously got very good.
Very fortunate. Yeah, she's going well. She lives up that way now, North Tarramurra. And she's a wonderful mum and grandmother to six grandchildren, actually, between my sister and I. Yeah.
Terrific. Now, you had a very varied career prior to coming into Parliament. We should just talk a little bit about that. Now, you had the rare privilege, I think relatively rare privilege, even though Mr. Howard was obviously in Parliament for a long time, but you got to work for the great man whose core fleet is behind us.
I did. What? Got one of those. I signed one of those.
Oh, well, we were saying we need to get that one signed to take it to the next level.
I can arrange that for you.
Now, what was it like to work for John Howard?
Terrific. I was young. I was 21. So I had worked for Joe Hockey when I was 20. Joe invited me. Having worked hard on his campaign for North Sydney, Joe said, well, if you'd like a role, you know, come into the office one day a week. So I used to run his feedback package. And then 18 months later, the opportunity arose to serve in the Bennelong electorate office. And
so at this stage, had you finished studying? Because you got a Bachelor of Business, I think.
I was at UTS. I was doing my BBs and LLB. Yeah, right. I was eight years doing two degrees, largely because I was, you know, busy working and engaged in politics, student politics, party politics, and but yeah, they were great. They were great years. I mean, I say this, there's no better schooling than to have served in the office of John Howard at the age of 21. And you know, I was there for nearly 5 years. So I started off one day a week, moved to 2 days a week, and then, you know, I'd sort of fill in for people when they were on leave. And then I was basically, you know, three of those 4.5 years roughly worked full-time. So served a sort of electoral term. And proudly so. And yeah, precious experience. He was firm but fair. A decent boss, he set very high standards, led by example, wasn't afraid to put red pen through my draft letters and notes and so on and so forth. But we did a lot. Part of my job actually was to take the box, we used to call it the Bennelong box, of letters, press clippings as we used to do them back then in a sense, footy tips, all sorts, the materials that for the week reflected what had happened in Bennelong, what needed to be turned around in Bennelong. I would take that to Kirribilli House. I'd drive to Kirribilli House and walk in with this black box of materials and sit in the study there at Kirribilli House, and he'd be signing and we'd be chatting, and you know, I'd be sitting there, and it was an amazing experience for a young bloke.
Well, that sounds really amazing. I mean, that was probably... What years were you in the...
From 1997 to 2002.
So you actually started before I was born and finished before I was born. but, you know, like any good young liberal, I've read Lazarus Rising multiple times, and it sounded like just an amazing period in Australian politics.
It was.
What sort of... Are there any things you learned that sort of stuck, like still stick with you today?
Number one, treat everyone with decency and respect. I saw John Howard do that, no matter who was in the office, who was coming in from, you know, significant figures on the world stage to, you know, humble local constituents on, you know, smaller sort of personal type issues. He would treat everyone the same way. And he was so consistent about that, and it just came very naturally. He would ask a lot of questions. I think to ask a lot of questions is a good thing in this world. He would always ask a lot of questions. And he would just keep on keeping on. I mean, I can remember times in the lead up to that 1998 election. It was not an easy...
The GST election.
Yeah.
Well, yes.
Where he was putting the GST to the Australian people. Indeed,
that was a tough campaign. And, you know, we'd lost a chief of staff and there were some big issues. Petrol prices, I remember, you know, there were big issues, Indigenous issues indeed. There were some significant issues confronting the Howard government early on in the life of the Howard government. And in fact, you know, at certain points, the polls were saying this government would not last very long. But he just kept on keeping on, you know, stuck to, I think, the sort of core, consistent John Howard values, you know, enterprise, hard work, decency, reward for effort, freedom, you know, personal responsibility. I think in the end, the hallmark of John Howard is the consistency, the clarity, and I think people came to respect that. Mm. And that's evident ultimately in his long and successful record.
Mm. You've said two things which really resonate with me. Many people have said to me, the John Howard that Jeanette Howard saw was the same John Howard that everyone else saw. That there was there was no difference in the man, consistency of treatment of everyone.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that many people have said to me, look, I didn't really agree with everything that John Howard did or stood for. But the thing that I admired about him was I was always convinced that he thought what he was doing was the right thing. Yeah. You know, he believed in what he said and did.
Yes.
And I think that's an important trait in a leader.
Absolutely right.
In any leader, but particularly a political leader.
So, I mean, there's lots of stories from over the years, but one that used to be told, I wasn't present for it, and I think this got told in the media, was, you know, one day there's John Howard out in a tough, you know, blue-collar marginal seat, and, you know, big burly tradie comes up to him and then says, John Howard, I can't stand you. And Mr. Howard's like, but I know what you stand for.
Mm.
And I think that story says a lot, you know, in terms of what it is that Mr. Howard did, how he engaged the Australian people. He wasn't there to be popular, never sought to be sort of liked as such, but was clear and consistent in his views and values and positions and policies that, you know, reflected those views and values. And I think in the end it's about respect, earning respect over a longer period of time and therefore having some authority. And authority does not come from being liked or popular. It comes from having a set of core values, putting them into practice and consistently practicing them and having people recognise that and hopefully over time grow to respect that and to have a level of trust and appreciation in you because that's what you do.
And the way he's held himself in his post-political career, to me, suggests that it was never about ego. It was always about serving the community.
Yeah, absolutely right. It was never about him. I mean, I think that's a great character of John Howard, the person, is just a real sense of humility and decency, no sort of airs or graces about him, knew who he was, you know, meant what he said, and was just so consistent over a long, long period of time in public life.
Now, after you stopped working for John Howard, you then really had a significant period of time in the private sector before ultimately you would come into Parliament. So you worked in a major law firm, Allens, one that I actually started in as a lawyer myself.
Yeah, good
firm. Albeit considerably period earlier than your starting time. Then you went to Pfizer, I think.
I did, yeah, about 3 years at Pfizer.
And had a number of commercial roles within that organisation.
Yeah.
Then went to Johnson & Johnson, and then you came back into politics for a short period of time as a staffer.
Lured back in when the O'Farrell government came.
Yeah, and then
Medicines Australia.
Medicines Australia.
Yeah.
And so what did you learn? And then you went to the Menzies Research Centre. We might talk about that in a second because Freya's also now connected with them.
Yeah.
But before you got to the Menzies Research, in those corporate roles, what were some of the things that you learned? What were some of the experiences that you had there?
They were very formative and valuable years. I mean, Allens in particular, but the other firms too. And I mean, each job and each role is unique, of course. But at Allens, I mean, I remember, you know, I joined Allens as a sort of graduate lawyer at the age of 26. And, you know, I had my 2 degrees and I'd worked in politics for 6 years and, you know, I thought, oh, I reckon I'm able to write, you know, advices and letters and case notes reasonably well. But it really, in a sense, brought me back down to earth. Not that I was sort of big on myself, but those partners at that firm were very particular, very demanding. You know, no one got any sort of, you know, favour or otherwise. It was a very competitive, hardworking landscape. Gave up a lot of weekends and evenings and public holidays and so on. I just, you know, worked very hard, as you do in these big city law firms. But it's so instructive, you know, in terms of your research, your writing, how you present an argument, how you make an argument, how you deal with clients and people. And, I mean, yeah, they were great years, very good years.
Great learning environment. Absolutely. Precision of language.
Yes. Immensely important. And, you know,
lots of red pen.
Yeah, there was. And I mean, that was... you know, I mean, that was so both in John Howard's office and at Allen's. And mm. you know, I think that is so precious, that training. And in a sense, it's different, right? I mean, political writing and legal writing can be quite different, in fact, as you well know. And so I think, in a sense, I got the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
The John Howard red pen and the Allen's partner red pen, mm. both immensely valuable,
I think. Yeah. Mm.
And it's probably, I mean, I think it's really worthwhile for young people to be in an environment that is so intense.
Yes.
When I first finished school, I worked at UBS for 2 years. Yes. And it was a very similar vibe,
yeah.
you know, working incredibly long hours, yeah. very intense, lots of pressure, hyper-competitive,
yes.
and surrounded by people that were extremely driven.
Yeah.
And I think in politics, I think there's sort of a bit of a political bubble people can sometimes get a bit caught up in,
mm.
but it's so good having that experience in a ultimately a business where you actually have to make money, and if the money doesn't come in, you don't perform, people don't pay you, well, someone's getting fired. Yep. And that's the reality. And what we see, I think, in sort of sometimes in the public sector and in big bureaucracies, and we're seeing it now, it's always easier to just pay your friends more when it's someone else's money.
Yeah.
And so and true. you lose some of that value. So yeah. I can imagine how important that would have been.
Yeah, it was. And I'll tell you a story, actually. So, I mean, after 4.5 years in John Howard's electorate office and my law degree was coming to an end, and I sat down and I said, well, Mr. Howard, I've nearly finished this law degree. My business degree was done a few years ago. And I'm thinking perhaps there might be an opportunity for me to go to Canberra to work in your office in Canberra. And he said to me, no, Tim. And I thought, oh. But he said, no, Tim. You've done this law degree and you've done it for a reason and you should put it to its natural application. And he said, go and get a real job in the real world. And that was immensely sound advice. And I would say it to any young Australian, whether you're interested in politics, have any aspiration for politics or otherwise, go and get a real job in the real world.
Mm.
No disrespect to the many people engaged in, you know, politics, public policy, public service, but a job in business, you know, or in a community or other such context is very instructive at a young age.
And Mr. Howe's been very consistent about that too, hasn't he? He said that he's decried the development of this sort of political class of staffers and so on, and said that it's really important to get people,
people
with that real world experience.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's a sensible and fair enough proposition. And I mean, I think the public benefit and I mean our party and I think our parliament's benefit when people are coming into parliament with insights, with skills, with qualifications, you know, earned experiences in whatever sector it might be or whatever space it might be that they've lived their life, but that adds to our overall capacity and capability, I think, in a parliamentary sense. And so I was really conscious of that. I mean, I think I knew at a young age, you know, as a young electorate officer, that this work meant a lot to me, but I always did hold the view that I should absolutely go and earn these degrees, put them into practice, and to have a job in the real world.
Now, interestingly, you now have, as part of your shadow ministerial responsibilities, effectively government regulation. Regulation, of course, largely being the bane of most of the private sector.
Yes.
Do you think that is going to be... that the fact that you've worked in the private sector as you have, no doubt that is of great assistance in terms of critiquing government regulation and proposals for more government regulation?
Yes, absolutely. You're right, in the fair trading portfolio, as well as in sort of building and work health and safety, that there is a lot of regulation of a lot of sectors and spaces of our economy and community, for that matter, too. And I think when you've had that experience, that lens of, you know, we're in business. And by the way, for a short period, I ran my own business as well. I sort of put out my shingle and worked for myself, which was also a very, you know, filed my BAS statement and insurance and so on and so forth and had to win some work and did. And I mean, that was very instructive too. And when you've had that experience and you are the subject of regulation, you know, that is something that you must adhere to. You must take time, effort, there's compliance, there's, you know, there's tax, there's the whole world of regulation in many layers and levels that you have to meet. I think it does give you cause to think twice about it in policy terms and to say, well, is this right? Is it responsible? Is it justifiable? Is this adding to the public good? Is this going to serve the best interests of, you know, our people, community and economy? And so I think that experience does help. I do think in a lot of ways in this country we are over-governed, over-regulated. I hear it a lot and I worry about it and I want to see action taken.
Now, one of the things that you spoke about in your inaugural address was housing affordability. And Freya, you often give the example of how much regulation adds to the cost of new housing.
Yeah, it can be up to half the cost of a new house.
Exactly.
It can be taxes, levies, duties, charges, etc., etc.
So, why isn't it as simple as just cutting all of that?
Well, if only it were so simple. I think, I mean, housing is one of those policy areas that cuts across all three levels of government. You know, we all know the roles that, you know, federal, state and local governments have to play. I think that does create a sort of level of some siloed thinking, some, you know, blame shifting, you know, impositions of costs at different layers and levels. It creates complexity. It creates difficulty.
But isn't the critical thing also, though, that with all that complexity and cost,
yes,
we're still getting apartment buildings that are being built with big structural problems. So
better now since the building commissioner.
Correct. I know. But yeah. isn't that fascinating in a sense that even with all that regulation, it still wasn't doing some of the basic jobs that I think probably the public would have thought it should be doing.
True. I think
so. Can you have good regulation without it adding as much to the cost?
Well, regulation adds cost to doing business by its very nature. It does. And the key, of course, to state the obvious, is to find the balance, you know, that point at which it is serving the public good, the interests of people, community, you know, and state more broadly. And there are times, I think, when we overdo it. And I mean, to some degree, these things can come in waves for various reasons, in various circumstances, for whatever, you know, means. But we've got to get that right. And we should always, always be asking ourselves, is any new regulation, any additional regulation strictly necessary? And so governments, and I note that a recent article said that in Canberra these are being taken away, is that sort of business regulatory impact statement that used to be a consistent obligation.
I think the coalition introduced that, didn't they?
I believe so. And so you've got Labor governments now that are less concerned about the
impact. They love regulation.
That
Their big answer to everything is to build a new public authority to deal with the problem rather than just dealing with the problem.
Well, that's right. And I mean, that's the antithesis of our liberal view, is to put our faith in people, to empower individuals, to put the individual's capacity, autonomy, responsibility above that of government, recognising the proper role for government and for regulation, as we've just been talking about. But the notion that the government is the answer is very, very rarely the case.
Well, I think I've quoted Ronald Reagan, who said that many people think the government will solve their problems, when in many cases it's the government that's created them. And if half of the cost of new housing is government regulation, that to me would, in terms of a housing shortage, you can probably think of no better example.
Well, quite right. I mean, I remember when I was at the Menzies, one of our board directors at the time was Tony Shepherd, and he authored a piece that said, from memory, 40 to 50%. In metropolitan Sydney. I mean, it can vary in different ways, but in metropolitan Sydney at the time, this was a few years ago now, but he said that is what is, you know, adding substantially to the cost of a new home and indeed preventing the construction of many new homes.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And it becomes, you know, a bit of a spiral down, because the less supply over the passage of time, and obviously demand for immigration and population growth and so on, so the problem just gets bigger over the passage of time.
And then you also have a flow-on impact to renters, because if the cost of housing is really high, I mean, people, and this is, I think, one of the big myths that the Labor government is trying to perpetuate, is, you know, there are these greedy landlords out there raking in the profits off the poor renters. Actually, if you look at the numbers, 70% of private landlords are mum and dad investors. Mm-hmm. And so, and they pretty much only own one property, the vast majority of them. And they're actually absorbing a lot of losses, which is seen through the rates of negative gearing. And if you think about the amount that their interest payments have gone up, the average mortgage payment is $20,000 a year higher than it was last year.
Let alone land tax and other costs.
Exactly.
So there's a lot of just fundamental economics here, isn't there? If it's cheaper to build houses, then we'll have more housing.
Mm-hmm.
If we have more housing, then there's more rental properties available. If there's an increase in supply, then the price will come down.
Yeah.
It's basic economics, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. You would think that governments would be more responsive to the fundamental laws of economics, but that's not always the...
hear much in government which is expressed in simple terms like that, do you?
No, well, true. And, you know, it was actually economic policy that led me to join the Liberal Party 30 years ago. Last month, in fact, it was August of 1993, I joined up. I was an economics student, and I loved economics. It was a favourite subject at school, and, you know, did pretty well. I had a great teacher. And this was 1993, the year of, you know, the so-called unlosable election, the fight back package, which was an excellent policy package, not well sold or communicated in electoral terms, but a very good package.
We've seen a bit about that lately, but yes.
And that was really the sort of driving force to me wanting to join the Liberal Party and to seek to be engaged in this space.
That whole GST debate. So in 1987 at the tech summit, Paul Keating wanted to introduce a goods and services tax, and Bob Hawke put the kibosh on it for politics.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the coalition came up with the very policy that Paul Keating believed in for the 1993 election, it was actually then Paul Keating, who went against what he knew was right, to opportunistically argue about how the GST was going to impact on birthday massive cakes and the
it was
like.
A huge scare campaign.
Which, and as you say, John Hewson, unfortunately, was a poor political salesperson, even though he was a good economist.
Yes, great policies, not well sold.
So you talked a little bit about taxation reform in your inaugural, and was that something that you worked on at the Menzies Research Centre, or did you do other things?
We didn't. I mean, to be honest, at the time, we didn't do that much in housing. I mean, our focus during the nearly 3 years I was there was understandably COVID. It was energy, a big focus on energy, and still is. Quite rightly so, a focus on some elements of law, you know, litigation funding, emergency response, the Royal Commission following bushfires. So there were many policies and points of focus that we made, a lot on, you know, competitive federalism as well, looking at, you know, across the states and understanding, you know, differences between New South Wales, Victoria and Queensland, among others. So housing we did not dive into in a big way, at least during the time I was there, but it is such a fundamental area of public policy. I mean, having a roof over our heads means so much. And it is so deeply affected, as we've been saying, by government policy, federal, state and local. And it's almost overwhelming, you know, when you look at the sort of various intersections and layers and levels of government intervention, taxation, regulation, in so many ways, in so many spaces, but it is not impossible, it is not insurmountable, and we do absolutely, as a country, need to dive into it and get that coordination across government, that dealing with silos, having more thoughtful, more economically driven policies that, you know, recognise consequences, that recognise costs and impositions of regulation. We've got to get that right.
And I reckon, I mean, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on this, but I think the debate, housing wasn't really front and center of the public policy debate a couple of years ago in the way that it is now. It seems like it sort of emerged as one of the key issues. And I don't know whether that's because, I mean, it's no secret, young people aren't voting for the Liberal Party. And a massive part of that is because 70% believe they'll never be able to own their own home. And so it leads to a sense of hopelessness, intergenerational warfare. And so maybe it's, do you think Like, why has housing sort of emerged as this new frontier of political battles?
It's not altogether new. I mean, it's always been there. I mean, I think certainly here in Sydney and really in a lot of ways across New South Wales, it's always been a big issue.
Everyone loves their harbour view.
It's particularly it's particularly acute at the moment, you know, for many reasons, with immigration taking off, you know, as we, you know, in the post-COVID landscape.
But for me, the big thing that has made it particularly bad in more recent times is that we had a situation where, because of supply chain problems in the construction industry, it suddenly became far more risky to build new housing as a consequence of COVID. That then meant, I think, that a lot of projects didn't proceed until the environment was more predictable, because the people who were wearing the risk were either the construction companies or the developers, and in some cases both. If the construction company had a lump sum contract which they couldn't perform at the price that was agreed, they either had to go out of business or renegotiate the amount of money. So it's been a very difficult environment to build housing, I think, in the recent years.
Yes, it has.
Whereas prior to the 19 election, and I know this as an MP, the blowback that we were getting from a lot of the community was you're building too many apartment buildings.
Interesting.
And there was none of that in the lead up to the 2023 election. It was a completely different debate.
True.
And the thing that really, I think the major thing was the disruption to the construction industry.
Mm. Yeah, really hard times. I mean, that sector, and every sector to some degree, relies upon a level of certainty, of stability, you know, of costings, of materials, of labour and so on. And yeah, it's been a tremendously challenging period for that sector. In recent times, though, and, you know, in the last few months as Shadow Minister, I've been engaging with a lot of builders, a lot of home builders, you know, at a local level and more broadly. I've just met today, actually, with Brian Seidler, who's a terrific advocate, the boss at the Master Builders Association, and things are getting back to a more stable, steady, stronger position. You know, interest rates, supply, labour market conditions, we're getting back to a more normal stable phase, and there's greater confidence and sentiment. At the same time, I think we've improved some policies. The appointment of the Building Commissioner was a good move, needed to happen. Standards are lifting. That's good news for the sector, but as much for the community as well.
Well, Tim, this has been a great chat. I apologise for my coughing and so on, but
not at all.
The back burning, and I'm an asthmatic, has been particularly challenging, but it's been a really interesting conversation, and I think it's terrific for our parliamentary team that we've got someone with your broad experience coming into the team and making a great contribution. I should ask you this, pretty hard act to follow when you're following a very popular former premier.
So I've known Gladys a long time. I was about 5 years behind Gladys in the Young Liberal movement.
Yeah.
And full of respect and appreciation for her hard work, tenacity and delivery for the people of Willoughby over 18 years, almost 5 years as Premier, a great figure in New South Wales politics, no question, and someone who I know at a local level and more broadly was just deeply appreciated, loved.
Very loved.
And respected.
Not just in Willoughby too.
Correct. Everywhere.
Correct. And so I am incredibly proud and humble to follow in those big footsteps, and I'm ever conscious of that, and I'm doing my level best every day to seek to replicate that hard work, that tenacity and that delivery that she became so well known for.
Can I just ask you a little bit about your local community? So one of Gladys's particularly great pearls was her story as, I'm going to call it, the little Aussie battler. You know, there she was. She turned up at primary school. She couldn't speak English. She came from an Armenian family and, you know, despite having no privilege, she went through the public education system and has done really well, you know, did a fantastic job as Premier and was a great servant of the public and the community, and she's now gone on into a successful corporate career as well. And there is quite a lot of Armenians that live in and around Willoughby.
Almost 4,000.
But there's been a bit of a change in the demographic. There's also a large Chinese community.
Very much.
And you've worked very closely with that community.
Yeah, I have. And I know exactly what you're saying. And I mean, the Gladys story is one of hard work, of aspiration, you know, of dedication. And I think that was a great part of her success story because it was relatable. And there are so many people who have chosen to make Australia their home, and including at a local level. You're quite right. Willoughby's a wonderfully diverse and successful and harmonious community. And these aspirational, hardworking people who are largely engaged in business, often small business, family business, individual enterprise, and they work very hard, and they are some of our greatest citizens. And I think, you know, that the lesson of Gladys Berejiklian is one that, you know, many people in Willoughby and right across New South Wales have come to know and appreciate. And it's hard work, it's have a go, it's, you know, build your life, take nothing for granted, give it your best. And she did that, and that's what now many other people are doing. And
in many sense, she embodied not just the migrant experience, but also the fact it was liberal values in action.
Very true.
You know, the Liberal Party wants to see people's hard work be rewarded.
Yes.
They want to see people get ahead in life.
Absolutely.
They want to facilitate people's capacity to be able to get ahead. And I think that has a broader engagement beyond the Armenian community, obviously, in your electorate, to all, you know, all people.
Yeah, it's the story of individual initiative. And I mean, I think this is innately the human spirit. We all want to have a better life. I think we are all naturally aspirational people. We want more for ourselves and our family. And I think we know that to do that, it's up to us to work hard, to take decisions, you know, to start businesses, to get things done, and that's how you get ahead in this world. It's not through, you know, government policies or
government handouts.
Correct, correct.
You've got to make your own way.
And in the housing context, I've got to say, there is absolutely an important role for social and affordable housing, but I do worry that Labor governments, state and federal, going to and are investing so significantly in those areas, but it is, in my view, that people inherently want to have their own home. They don't want the government owning part of their home. They don't want the government necessarily, you know, having control or, you know, to be renting from the government or otherwise. People want their own roof over their own head. And I think that is the natural aspiration of people. And that's what we need to create the conditions for.
We need to create the conditions so that people can own their own home, that Absolutely. They can have confidence in the people of Freya's generation don't feel as if they're an outsider in their own community, but that they can actually buy a bit of the community that they're living in.
Correct.
Yeah.
We can do it.
Yeah.
And we must.
We can. We have to. We have that obligation.
Indeed.
To our younger generations.
Mm. Correct.
And future generations.
Very conscious of it for my children.
Yeah.
I want them to be.
Yeah,
able to
my
have
children
a
home. Too. Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm very conscious of it. Absolutely. Mm.
One of the things you just said that you looked at the Menzies Research Centre
energy policy.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, Tim, one of the things that you said you looked at the Menzies Research Centre was energy policy. What were the sorts of things that you were looking at?
We had a particular focus on gas because New South Wales needs more gas. And there are, you know, some terrible policies over the passage of time across Australia that have hampered our capacity to generate gas. Gas is a vital partner going forward for renewables as we transition out of coal. Gas is a vital.
It's incredibly complementary to renewables because gas allows electricity generation to instantaneously increase and decrease.
Correct.
Which can complement changes in wind and solar.
Yeah, it is in a lot of ways the best friend to renewables. We're, Australia is not going to see great success in the renewables space if we don't have gas.
At least in the short term.
Correct.
There may be longer term.
Well, indeed.
Replacements for gas.
Yeah.
And what are some of those, do you think?
One of them that I'm personally passionate about, happy to say so, have said so for many years, and I think for compelling reasons, is nuclear. You know, of the G20 nations around the world, Australia is the only one that is either not looking into or currently supplying energy from nuclear sources.
Mm.
We hold about a third of the world's uranium. The technology and advancement in that space has come such a long way. This is not the 1970s. And as you look at Europe and America and so many parts of the world, we'd be mad if we did not have a good look at nuclear and at least create the conditions in which that is on a viable path.
Such a good point. We talked about this last week in our podcast, and especially if you think about where we are struggling as a party to speak to voters, it's how do we actually deal with the climate change risks that we're going to encounter as a country while keeping the lights on, while not burdening households with super expensive energy prices. Mm-hmm. And I think nuclear just seems like such an obvious choice.
Well, it's an important part of the mix.
I
think that's the way you look at
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
That it's great for baseload power. It allows, if the modular nuclear reactor technology can be properly rolled out, it will allow those small nuclear reactors to then go in areas that have traditionally had coal-fired power stations. You can use all the same transmission and other infrastructure. Yes. It's potentially quite an effective and good.
Well, indeed. And I'll say this, I mean, Labor's ban on nuclear, state and federal, is positively archaic. And it is driven by politics. It is wholly unjustifiable. And it's up to our state and country to get smarter about it, to get ourselves into the modern era in relation to nuclear, and to have a good look, and I think, to make it part of our future energy mix.
And if we're going to have nuclear submarines coming into Sydney Harbour or Newcastle Harbour or Wollongong Harbour or wherever around Australia, it does seem strange that you couldn't have a similar sized reactor on land anywhere within the state.
Well, indeed. I mean, and we have nuclear down here at Lucas.
Yeah.
We've got housing around
it. And has served us well and continues to in so many ways, including in relation to nuclear medicine.
Correct. Mm. And great expertise in nuclear medicine and handling a nuclear reactor.
Correct.
I was very fortunate to go around the Lucas Heights facility as Minister for Science. And they've got a great innovation park there, by the way, as well. And people from all over the world are coming there. But one really interesting thing is that reactor there at Lucas Heights, they told me, has the smallest number of down days when it doesn't operate of any reactor in the whole world.
Wow.
It is one of the best, most effective nuclear reactors in the world. So, you know, we have
this a deal of experience. Got a lot to offer. You know, we have the smarts, the people, the capacity, the resources to do it. We just need some political courage to get down that path.
And I think you are right in pointing out that virtually no modern Western economy has zero interest in having nuclear generation as part of its ecosystem.
Correct. This is the future, and Labor should get on board.
Well, on that uplifting note, can I thank you very much for joining us on Macquarie Street Matters, and
pleasure.
It's been great having a chat with you.
Great
thank
pleasure.
You.
Anytime.
Well, it's been a really interesting sitting week that has just taken place this week in Macquarie Street. Really, one of the big issues, I suppose, has been integrity again, but I guess that's been off the back of new polling which suggests that the Minns government has really been tanking in the polls.
That was quick.
The only way you can think of it is, Kim Kardashian has had longer marriages than Chris Minns's honeymoon politically. I mean, it's been incredibly short, almost unprecedented. I mean, it's only 6 months or so from the state election, and already people clearly unhappy with the performance of the government. Not surprising given the number of broken election promises and scandals that have plagued this government. And so all the usual bump that a new government gets in terms of its vote has completely disappeared. And so we're definitely back to a much tighter political environment, which is obviously good for the coalition. And I think what it does show is that people are actually picking up on what we've been talking about, which is the complete lack of direction in the New South Wales government. So they're inexperienced, without real direction. Their main motivation seemed to be to get into government, not why they wanted to get into government. And I think that's actually coming clearer and clearer. But just as people are explaining this drop in the polls for Chris Minns and the New South Wales Labor Party as being a function of scandal and disarray, you know, we've had Josh Murray, we've spoken about all of those. We've had two new things that have happened this week. We've had questions asked in Parliament about Joe Halen's potentially breaching the ministerial code. So there were questions asked in Parliament on Thursday about the fact that she owns two properties very close to Marrickville Railway Station, one 300 metres, the other 550 metres. The questions in Parliament, she agreed in answer to a question in Parliament that the metro from Sydenham to Bankstown would substantially uplift the value of properties near the metro line, which included her investment property and her family home. But also, when she was asked questions about, did you separately follow Clause 10 of the Ministerial Code and advise the Premier about these properties and about a conflict of interest in relation to you dealing with the metro, she was evasive. It really appeared as if she hadn't followed the ministerial code, at least from what we could tell from her answers. She was also asked, did you seek DPC legal advice on the conflict of interest? Did you get, you know, the DPC, the bureaucrats that administer the ministerial code? And she didn't seem to answer that. And it didn't appear as if she obtained legal advice on the conflict. And then at the end of that question in question and answer in Parliament, what was really interesting was that there was then a very animated discussion at the end of the chamber, quite extraordinary that it wasn't done in a more professional fashion. But really the Premier seemed to sort of pull her aside with Ron Honig, the Leader of the House, and they were having a three-way powwow, which interest the media. In fact, a couple of the journalists were bending over from the press gallery trying to watch what was going on underneath. But and this is, I think, one of the things that people don't see in the general public is just how agitated and hot-headed Chris Minns gets in Parliament. He really doesn't seem to handle the pressure of the contest of ideas well.
Or an incompetent team.
so when he's just sort of in the media, he comes over as being this avuncular knock-around bloke, but he really kind of loses his cool in the chamber, and it's quite noticeable, and he's constantly, you know, constantly getting agitated and screaming out and carrying on. So it's quite, you know, he's not the sort of the rational, reasonable guy that he projects or tries to project himself as in the media. So that was a bit, that was some of the interesting things. And then, of course, it's broken in the media some of the details around around Tim Crackenthorpe, the sacked minister who's been referred off to the ICAC by Chris Minns. And it appears as if not only did he apparently try and hide the property holdings of his family, which one of the newspapers reports is conservatively valued at tens and tens and tens of millions of dollars in Newcastle, but that he also tried to charge a private holiday for his family down to the South Coast, which I believe he grew up down on the South Coast, so he may have been visiting family, but he tried to charge that to his ministerial expense account.
Oh my God.
Now, apparently it wasn't charged, but he at least tried to do it. So, you know, you've got a situation where I think it was only a week after he'd become a minister, he's already trying to inappropriately take taxpayers' money for personal benefits.
That is profoundly incompetent, though.
It is.
That's not just a mistake or a slip up. That's really concerning.
I mean, I must say that it reminds me a little bit of when I first came into Parliament. And I came into Parliament with Chris Minns and Joe Halen and Tim Crackenthorpe and a whole lot of them back in 2015.
Mm.
And when we had the orientation session, most of the Labor MPs were completely zoned out. But when it came to entitlements, they suddenly started all paying attention and asking questions. And there were seven new coalition members. We were just in hysterics because, you know, it became quite clear that a big motivation of a lot of the Labor MPs seemed to be an interest in what their entitlements were and the financial arrangements around how they could claim benefits back for themselves. And to be trying to run or pay for a family holiday a week after you become a minister on the taxpayer, if it's true, I mean, that's what's reported today in the newspaper, it's just pretty appalling, isn't it?
Look, Labor loves their public sector wages. Let's not forget that MPs are on public sector wages. So, yeah. You know, they love it, clearly.
It's true. I mean, you know, very, very few, if any, of the Labor MPs would have been self-employed like I was for over 20 years before I came into Parliament. That's the reality of it.
I mean, lots of them were staffers.
Lots of them have been on either the union payroll, the taxpayer payroll, or the Labor Party payroll in terms of being apparatchik. I mean, I think that's all pretty much Chris Minns has ever done, just work for the Labor Party or work for as a staffer. There's not a lot else there that he's actually ever done with his life. So it's an indication of a mindset and a life experience.
And especially a mindset when you never have to earn money. You don't understand, like, when you're always just benefiting off the other's hard work, their union fees, their Labor Party membership fees, the taxpayer dollars, because all these staffers are just paid, this is your money paying these people. I think it would instill in you a bit of a, you just take it for granted, you know, everyone loves a free lunch. And that's not good, and it means, you know, things like this start to happen.
You're reminding me of Milton Friedman. He always said there's no such thing as a free lunch, so
the party members love it.
Now, and I guess the other thing that happened this week is Labor again trying to create this false narrative around it's going to be a horror budget because the budget's in such bad shape. Excuse me. Come back.
I'm just going to adjust this so it's actually okay.
Yeah.
Distance.
Yeah, good idea. So I think the sort of the core falsehood at the last election that assisted Labor to be re-elected was this notion that they could do away with the public sector wages cap and that any wage rises for the public service would be fully funded. Now, we can have a debate around the desirability of increasing, you know, the wages of teachers and nurses and so on. I think that's a legitimate public policy debate. But the lie was not around them saying, we believe that that's what we should do. The lie was, we believe that's what we should do, we can do it, and it will be neutral to the budget. And because what happened when Labor was last in power, and we're now seeing essentially a repetition of that, is that the reason that they were unable to build infrastructure was because their expenditure on public sector wages always took all of the revenue growth of the government. And so they never had a gap between revenue growth and public sector wage expense that could allow them to build infrastructure or build more infrastructure. My bed used to have this great graph, which was public sector wage increases and revenue increases during the Labor government, and the public sector wage increases were always greater than the revenue increases. And when we came into power with the wages cap, which, by the way, for the first 11 years of the government before COVID pushed inflation through the roof, the wages cap in New South Wales delivered real wage increases every year up until COVID. So for the first 10 years of the coalition government until COVID came, public servants were better off than inflation, and they were better off than in the private sector. They actually got more growth than the private sector over the same period. Labor have tried to spin the last, 18 months when inflation was rampant because of COVID as somehow meaning that for the whole period of the coalition government, public sector wages were terrible. They weren't. They were actually very, very good for the first 10 years. But what's now happened is that we're now going to revert back to not having revenue increasing more than the public sector wages, but back the other way. And that's going to create massive structural problems for the budget.
And it means things have got to go. They will have to cut stuff.
That's why active kids are getting cut. That's why seniors travels cards are getting cut. That's why apprenticeship
travel cards
are being cut. There's cut. Cut. Labor want to spin it as being it's all because of the bad fiscal management of the coalition, but in fact it's all about the choices that they have taken with regard to their budget.
Exactly. And when does the budget come out?
So the budget will be delivered on Tuesday morning.
So that'll be the day after this podcast goes up. So make sure you stay tuned for that. And I'm sure next week we'll do a big rundown on the budget and give you guys an update.
We will.
Awesome. Thanks, Alistair.
Thank you. Thank you, Freya.